At bestvolleyballvideos.com, we have over 150 hours of training videos developed specifically for the youth and high school age volleyball player. Please go to bestvolleyballvideos.com. Hello, everybody. This is the fourth episode in a four-part series of podcasts called The Purpose of Practice. And if you've listened to the other three, we've kind of evolved from the very basic concepts of player development through practice into training. And then this last session, this last episode is going to be on competition. And I'm going to dive into the weeds in a lot of areas here. This might be a fire starter for some people. But I want to talk about the way we compete at the youth and junior level and why we do it. And I also want to look at, you know, possible alternatives. And I'm going to give some critiques on some things that I don't think are good. And we'll go from there. But I think we have a lot to unpack today and cover. So let's get started. Yeah. My natural instinct as a coach and as a director was to always ask myself, you know, how can I be better? How can we do things differently? What can we do different to make ourselves better? Whether it's our team, whether it's training, whether it's new methodologies in training, anything to be better. And the one thing I was always, I prided myself on was I was always excited to learn and grow and develop and to gain more knowledge. And so, you know, what you're going to hear is going to be, you know, kind of the summary of everything that, you know, that I've gone through over the last four decades, but also just looking at the landscape, because generally history has a tendency to repeat itself and it comes back around again. And I think we're seeing that at some point in time in junior volleyball as well. But we're going to take a deep dive today into this whole thing, player development, more importantly, how it affects the competitive model in a system. And back in 2021, I did a two podcast called A Broken System. And, you know, one of the things, if you listen to this podcast series, is maybe go back and listen to those as well, because I'm going to dive into some of those areas a little bit deeper. But this is something I did back in 2021, just to look critically at ways to maybe be better at what we do already. So, but first, I'm going to talk about basketball and the lessons, good and bad, that volleyball coaches and directors can learn from you know, things that I see in the sport of basketball as well. And first thing I'm going to talk about is Caitlin Clark. And I had never, I mean, probably everybody's heard of Caitlin Clark by now, but I had never seen her play until this year. And, you know, I watched two or three games this year. I read a lot about her, did some research on her, things like that. But, you know, the one thing that struck me was her level of skill. Is she a once-in-a-generation physical athlete? No. I mean, she's not super tall. She doesn't jump out of the gym. She's not faster than anybody else in the basketball court. But she shoots, and she dribbles, and she passes like a man, which puts her in a unique position in terms of what she's capable of doing on the basketball court. And I'm going to go into some thoughts about that, because I think in the sport of basketball, if you follow basketball, people love Steph Curry. Steph Curry can shoot the ball from almost anywhere in the gym. He's a great ball handler. And Caitlin Clark possesses a lot of those shoot, pass, dribble skills that the great men exhibit. And I think that makes her unique to a lot of people are used to watching women's basketball, because she just looks different doing it. She takes her shots from further away. You know, she's aggressive with the ball, and you know, so she's, you know, she's unique in that sense. And I think that's one of the things that people like about her is that she you see her play the game different than any female who's played that position or performed those skills. And, you know, and it generates to, and the reason I say she plays like a man is because the men are bigger, they're faster, they're stronger, they jump higher, you know. So when you, from the eye test, Caitlin Clark is doing things that we've seen, you know, we've rarely seen women's basketball players do. So I think that's, you know, and the other thing I'd like to talk about, and I've talked about in other podcasts, is think about Caitlin Clark's background from the time she was young And, you know, she's played X number of games. She's gone through X number of hours of practice. But also, let's also think about how many hours of practice has she gone through just by herself, or just unorganized, or just random, or just herself and maybe one other person. Because, you know, this goes back to what I want to talk about in our sport of volleyball, because, you know, she's played a number of games. Obviously, there's a finite amount of games she's played. She's had so many team practices. But how much time has she put in outside of those two areas to hone her skill and make herself the player that she is today? And, you know, if you Google Caitlin Clark, you know, I just Googled Caitlin Clark playing against boys, and one of the first articles that came up was, Iowa star Caitlin Clark recalls why playing with boys since childhood set attitude benchmark as an athlete. And, you know, this is going to go to, you know, one of the things I'm going to talk about today, which is quality of play and difficulty of play versus the volume of play, which, you know, we're kind of hung up on now in this country, is we just want to play as much as we can, and most of it is just worthless. And I'm going to get into that a little bit later as well. But I think Caitlin Clark is a great example of an athlete who, you know, she's redefining what that position plays, because, you know, she's a girl or a young woman who's modeling and looks more like a man. I mean, and it, from the sense of how she's playing the game. I'm not talking about from a physical appearance, but I'm talking about how she's playing the game. I mean, her skills are her skill set's transcending what we're used to seeing in women's basketball. So another area I want to talk about is, I want to talk about March Madness. And as I was watching March Madness this March, I was thinking about how college, men's college basketball translated to women's volleyball. And the reason I bring this up is because we saw Oakland beat Kentucky in the first round of the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship. We saw Yale beat Auburn. Auburn won the SEC tournament by 20 points. And we saw Yale, a team with no scholarship athletes, beat Auburn. And the thing that I ask myself, excuse me, the thing I ask myself is, how can a team like Oakland, who might have one or no potential future NBA players on it, beat a team like Kentucky, which is always loaded with players who are going to be, at one point in time, going to be playing in the NBA? I mean, the skill or the potential or the physicality is so much different between Oakland and Kentucky, and the same is for Yale and Auburn. How do basketball teams with far inferior physical athletes beat these teams that are loaded with, you know, just superior players and talent? And one of the things that, I mean, there's tactics and there's things like that, but one of the things that I always look back at is all of these basketball players on both sides, for Oakland and for Yale, they've played tons of basketball. It kind of goes back to the Caitlin Clark comment. They've played the game at a high level for a long time. Now, they may not be at the same level as the Kentucky players and the same level as the Auburn players, but they have a high level of skill. And most of their skill was acquired outside of a formal practice setting or outside of a formal gameplay. You know, they played high school. They probably played AAU basketball, which we're going to get into in a little while. They probably, they had their practices, but they also probably, as young athletes, spent a tremendous amount of time practicing on their own, or, you know, with their friends, to hone their skills, to make themselves better players. And, you know, I'm going to go down this road and talk about this concept of skill development being something that's such a high priority when you become a competitive athlete, that I think it's really important. And, you know, the third lesson that I want to bring up from this past basketball season was Dawn Staley, the South Carolina women's coach, who they won the national championship, beat Caitlin Clark's team in the final. But she had a comment, or she made a comment, about how good the scrimmage team that her South Carolina team plays against every day in practice was. And it's a team of all men, or all college boys. And she talked about how great that team was. And if you think about it, she's got five people playing against her team that would probably beat any women's college team, might beat any women's WNBA team, might beat any women's team in the world, because just of the physical superiority of the guys. She gets to play against that every day. And so think about in your gym or in your competitive arena, if you had something or somebody like that to challenge and harden your team. And I think that's one of the things that when she made that comment, it was clear, because I remember being in China. I've been in China several times and watching, you know, the best teams over there. They're almost always playing against all men because you want to play a superior physical opponent. So when you get in the arena with other great women's teams, you're comfortable being in that environment because you've been playing against somebody who's even more physical and faster than the team that you're on the court with at that point in time. And so I think that's really, really important. So again, it goes back to the quality of your competition. And then, you know, the last thing about basketball I want to talk about is, you know, or the next to the last thing is AAU basketball is a model. And I'm not talking about the organization of AAU, but I'm talking about what people call AAU basketball. And, you know, which is the spring and summer basketball circuit, basically. And it's, you know, AAU has it, but the shoe companies also have all their own tournaments. So, but it's called AAU basketball. But years ago, Kobe Bryant was extremely critical of the AAU basketball model because he talked about players playing all the time, but lack of skill development, lack of fundamentals, lack of volleyball knowledge, lack of training, as opposed to just play, which, you know, teams would get together and play five or six games on a weekend, and they would have virtually little or no practice during the week, and, you know, which sounds a lot like the club circuit in volleyball. And so one of the things that, you know, you look at is you look at the model that you want your team or your teams or your club, you know, and because, again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning, like, I always want to examine what we're doing and how we can do it better. And when I was at Sports Performance, you know, long, long time ago, our 18 elite team would play close to 100 matches in a season. But by the time I had left, we were playing maybe less than half of that. And our teams were still playing at about the same level or maybe better. And so I just felt like we got much, much more efficient in what we were doing. And we had to play a lot less. And so I think that's one of the things. And again, that's going to be one of the main themes of this podcast is, you know, how do we address this madness, which is the USA Junior Development System. And one of the things I would look at, I think there's three articles that I would recommend that all of you go find and read. And, you know, the first one is from the New York Times, June 2nd, 2010. And the title of the article is How a Soccer Star is Made. And it goes to, it basically does an in-depth story on the Ajax, which is spelled A-J-A-X. It sounds like Ajax, but I think it's pronounced Ajax. But the Ajax Youth Development Academy in Holland. And it goes into detail about how great soccer players are made. How, you know, these kids are young; they start training at a young age. There's a focus on it's 100% focused on player development, and it goes through, you know, kind of the steps that they take these kids through to become world class. Because then, when they become world class, these other rich clubs come in, like Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester United. And they buy these players' contracts for tens of millions of dollars. But they're only going to buy the contract of a great player. They're not coming to buy a team. They're coming to buy a player. So, and it's a long article, but How a Soccer Star is Made, June 2nd, 2010, New York Times. I think that's one thing that I would recommend that you read. Another article is called Inside the Decade-Long Plan to Bring Victor Wembanyama to NBA Glory. And that's ESPN.com, May 15th, 2023. And Wembanyama just won the NBA Rookie of the Year award, I think yesterday or the day before. And he is kind of a freak of nature, but he had a long-term plan. He's from France, but the development model that he went through is the antithesis of what American basketball kids go through. And I would recommend that you read that as well, because it allows you to take a peek into, you know, what this guy did, the plans that they had for him, why he did the things he did. It was all geared on becoming a world-class basketball player. And the last article I would look at is from Hoops Habit, HOOPSHABIT.com, November 25th, 2023. And it's titled "The European Advantage, Unveiling the Secret to International NBA Stars' Recent Dominance." And it goes into why the European players are dominating the NBA. They're dominating the NBA from the Defensive Player of the Year point of view. They're dominating the NBA in so many different ways. And, you know, the premise is that, you know, their skill level is so high. Their fundamentals are so good. They play within the team concept so well. And I think one of the things that fascinates me about, you know, the Ajax story and this Wembanyama story and all the others is there, it always evolves around long-term systematic development of individual talent. And in turn, when you put that talent together within a club structure like you run, if you're a club director or you're a coach or even a high school program, you can have a far better team because you have great players and you have players with no weaknesses. So that's one of the things I think that's really important. So I would suggest all of you, you know, do your homework on that, because I think there's a lot of great information there. And if you're like me and you like to learn, I think you're going to be fascinated by some of the Ajax story is, you know, from 2010. You know, I read that story years and years and years ago. It was one of the ways that we started our youth academy, built our youth academy at Sports Performance, tried to take so many lessons from that. Just with, you know, the competition wasn't important. The training, the intense training, the quality of the difficulty that the kids were going through, the challenges they faced in their training environment. You know, competition was an afterthought when the kids were young. It was just like, we have to train you to be the best soccer machine possible, basically. So I think that's one of the things. And so I want to kind of compare this to the USA model that we currently have in place. And, you know, most kids play high school volleyball from August to early November. They play 30, 40 matches a year in a 60, 70-day window from the beginning of September through October, sometimes into early November if their teams are making runs toward the state tournament. You know, most kids will go right into club from high school volleyball starting in mid to late November. And unless you're a senior, you're going to often play into early July. In club, you're going to play 60 to 80 matches on sport court, which is laid directly on concrete. It's not uncommon to see kids as young as 15 or 16 now. They're wearing KT tape on their legs. They've got knee braces, shoulder issues, knee sleeves on their knees, ankle braces. I mean, we have an epidemic of overuse injuries because we play too much and we play on concrete. And I've said that before, and you know, it's something that college coaches would never have their kids do because they understand the dynamics of it. But that's kind of our system right now. And then to go into the next phase of it, between President's Day and the end of April, we have the 75-day gold rush for players to play as much as possible in front of as many college coaches as possible. At the same time, for teams to play as much as possible to earn their bids to nationals in one of the five or six divisions in every age group that they have for nationals now. And to me, this system is the very definition of insanity. And, you know, I've talked on other podcasts about the USA system. It's a complete outlier to all other developmental systems in the world. You know, the USA has several hundred thousand players playing on a year-round basis. We've got a college system with 30,000 players, where many of those players are given a free education, and now they're actually paid to play volleyball. So we have the most populated and the most financially supported system in the world. But if you take the top 10 players in each position in the world, the USA is not going to dominate in numbers in those positions. You know, it's not that the USA doesn't have great players, it does. But there's just a lot of great players in the world who have gone through a much different system that was different in nature, and they still became great players. And in a lot of instances, much better than the U.S. players. You know, while they're playing far fewer matches, their families were spending a fraction of the money that American families spend to become better players and to be in better positions as volleyball players. And one of the things you look at is, one of the things I look at is when a new coach gets hired somewhere. Let's say you have to rebuild a college program almost right away. What do? They go overseas. They travel. They bring in foreign players all over the world. And it's almost an instant quick fix. And those players, even though we have this system in place where kids are playing volleyball all year, over 100 matches a year, parents are spending tens of thousands of dollars, why do college coaches look outside this country if they need to rebuild a college program right away? And it, to me, it goes back to the training model that other countries have. It goes back to so many meaningless matches that our kids play here, which just piles on the reps, piles on the game reps, piles on the overuse, as opposed to the quality of work. So, you know, and I guess my question is, why isn't the USA system dominating? Why don't we dominate world volleyball? I mean, we have by far the deepest talent base, probably spend more money in total on expenses and training volleyball than any other 10 countries combined. And I think, and to me, the answer is simple. The model that we currently have restricts overall player development. It promotes club and team success and kind of a never-ending quest for bragging rights. And I know that to be true because I lived in that world for so long. And so I think that's one of the things that we want to think about as volleyball leaders and directors. Is this the best way? Is this as good as it's going to get? Is this we just going to keep going down this road indefinitely, you know, for as long as it lasts? And, you know, it's, I think another thing to look at is if you're a club director or even if you're a coach, if you're a parent, it's much easier to play a lot and practice a little. You know, systematic and organized training requires a lot of planning, a lot of knowledge. You know, coaches need to be hungry to learn and grow their own knowledge base. You know, and currently it's not easy being a coach in youth and junior sports due to what seems like more and more conflict between coaches and parents. You know, on top of that, adding a coach who already has a family and possibly a full-time job and ask them to put more time in, you know, it puts them in a bind. And I understand that dilemma, but that's an issue for a different time. But I think there are some issues there, and it's much easier to get coaches who will put in 4 hours a week than it is to get a coach who will put 14 hours a week in, unless you're going to pay somebody to work full-time for you. So I realize that's one of the issues, but it doesn't change the nature of the beast that we're talking about right now. And, you know, the title of this episode is It's 2007 All Over Again. And in 2007, the Junior Volleyball Association, the JVA, was formed, and it was actually called the JVDA for a little while. But it was put in place to provide an affordable and an alternative model to what many of us viewed as a junior system that was headed down a path that was going to be out of control cost. Leadership was dictating policy to its customers rather than listening to its customers and then responding accordingly. So, you know, the JVA wasn't formed. Everybody thinks it was a war with USA Volleyball, but that wasn't the case at all. It was meant to be a competitive model that would allow some of us to follow an alternative path towards player and team development. You know, while we wanted to spend less money. I mean, the biggest thing for me when we went was it was going to be less costly. The quality of play was probably going to go up or at least stay the same, but it was going to be much more affordable and it was going to be much easier to handle it. And I think one of the things that people, you know, you got to think about is that competition makes people and organizations better. You know, when you have competition, you know, they work for the customer. They don't dictate policy to the customer. And the opposite of that is when you have a monopoly where clubs have very few choices. And I think in some ways we're headed back in that direction again. You know, I look across the landscape of junior volleyball in 2024, and parents are spending record amounts of money to have their kids involved in junior volleyball. I've spoken to numerous parents who will spend over $20,000 a year for a club season. You know, I've talked to some who have spent over $25,000, and we had a mom tell us just a couple days ago that they're going to spend close to $30,000 this year because they're going to fly four or five times. It's going to be three or four nights of hotels, rental cars, you know, airline tickets, multiple airline tickets, over and over and over again. So it's not uncommon to have a $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 weekend when you're off at a qualifier or a tournament. So I think, you know, I think that is one of the things that to me is the most concerning, which I'm going to get in a little bit later because of our situation now here in Atlanta. But I mean, and another thing is, what are the results of this never-ending quest to spend more money? Are more kids getting scholarships? No. There aren't really any more colleges giving scholarships, but also the transfer portal not recruiting has had the greatest impact on the development of college programs because college coaches can instantly improve themselves in the transfer portal. They're taking a shot or a gamble with a high school kid who's maybe still 2 or 3 years away from coming in. So they're going to keep recruiting high school players. But as a high school player, when you get to the college that you committed to, you have no idea what the landscape's going to look like because, you know, one of the best players in the country could just come right in and take a position away from the position you thought you were going to have or your daughter was going to have or your player was going to have. And, you know, that's changed the recruiting so much because now the portal gives you instant success as opposed to you have to develop it, you have to recruit it, you have to train it. So I think that's one of the areas that I see as well. But and I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a Facebook group called Volleyball Moms, and it's got over 80,000 members. It's a private Facebook group. And I think almost every state has a separate Facebook group as well. So I know there's one in Georgia here with maybe 2,000 or 3,000 members. The main group has 80,000, but you know, I'm looking through some of the stuff that's written on there, and here's a few excerpts from Volleyball Moms. And think about moms. Moms control the checking accounts in a lot of families. They spend the money. And so here's a few. I work full-time job, as does my husband, and we still are having a very hard time affording club volleyball. And I wonder if anybody does side jobs online while they're on the road traveling. Somebody says, how on earth do you afford this? My son plays, and this season is going to end up costing us about $20,000 total. Dues right at $8,000, all of our travel expenses. It breaks my heart. I don't know if I can continue to do this. All right. And it goes on with, hey, moms, real concern. Just wondering how you were able to pay club fees, camp, travel, privates, uniforms, parking, strength. Where do you all work? If you do, I want that job. And then somebody responds, this is not the same sport my girls played in club in high school and college. Club fees have gone up. Competition is high. As a parent, you can no longer look to this sport as an entry-level high school sport. Think your inexperienced player will make the team and maybe play in college. Those days are long gone. And she says, I have two former national travel players who could have purchased them each a new nice compact car each year for what we spent playing on club volleyball. Their fourth car when they completed club. However, the father said, when you're done. So this goes on and on and on. And, you know, somebody says, how important is it to be on a national team, travel team at 13 years of age? All the money currently goes towards that. So I have no money to do anything else. And there's one thing that's kind of funny. There's somebody who posted a picture. She's got her hand out at the tournament. She said, I'm showing off my most expensive piece of jewelry. And it's the admission band that they put around your wrist when you go inside a volleyball tournament. So I think that I've said in past podcasts that inflation is real and the spending habits of people, I mean, not a lot of families have $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 of disposable income to spend every year. And it's one of the things that concerns me. And I'd like to compare this to, you know, what the boys have recently done. And I did an entire podcast on this, but the junior boys community virtually in whole left USA Volleyball. And they left the qualifier system. They left chasing the bid. They left a lot of that stuff. And the boys have a unique, the boys are unique in some ways because there's not many scholarships in boys volleyball. So the money that parents put out a lot of times doesn't come back. It doesn't come back as an investment. It's just money that's spent. And what the boys did was the boys basically said, you know what, we're going to control our own destiny. So the boys junior community, which I think is really good, they have two big national tournaments a year plus their national championship. One of the national tournaments is held generally, I think, east of the Mississippi. All the teams in the country come to that tournament. And then there's one tournament, I think, held in Southern California, which is, there's a high number of teams on the West Coast in Northern California and Southern California. And then all the boys' teams go to the AAU championships. All the top teams go to the AAU championships in Orlando. I think there was over 1,000 boys' teams there last year. And what that has done is it's given the boys basically three national championship events every year. They all meet east of the Mississippi, they meet in California, and then they go to nationals. So they can pretty much plan their entire season out, and then everything else is generally around in their local power leagues and events and things like that. But, you know, they were smart because, you know, they kind of stopped the madness before it got too crazy. You know, when you go to one of those three tournaments, all the best teams are going to be there. It's going to be money really well spent for you. You know, all the college coaches are going to be there. You know, it's not going to be where the girls are headed now with so many different events at the same time where, you know, if you think you're going to play in front of college coaches, but there's four or five or six big major events going on the same weekend, you know, that's just not going to happen. So I think that's, you know, the boys were smart. It's one of the things that they looked at. And, you know, for me, you know, the JVA, in a way, it's sad because the JVA started to compete and to offer a competing model where people could choose. And unless you're, if you're not going to have a competing model, then, you know, I think one of the things you do is you lose your customer base of people who would want that model. And, you know, originally there were several clubs who just went to the JVA, and it wasn't, everybody thinks it was the war, the battle against USAV, but it was just better. It was better for our clubs. Virtually all those clubs have left the JVA because the JVA in the beginning, if they would have put a plan together to build a better mousetrap, just say it that way. If they would have built a better mousetrap, the customers are going to come to you. But they didn't. And, you know, it's, you know, I remember in 2007 when the JVA was formed, there was a lot of concern just because of the qualifiers were expanding and the state of play was going to be eaten into everybody's pocketbook. And, you know, we could see that more and more and more qualifiers were going to come, which means it was going to spread out the competition. It was going to water down the competition. And also, it was going to, you know, if your commitment was to go to nationals and play at a high level, to guarantee that you had to almost commit yourself to multiple qualifiers. Because for so many years, everybody went to one or two. And usually you just drove. Everybody went to one or two. And I remember in 2007, I was at a meeting in Minneapolis. We were discussing the qualifier system in the JVA. And where it was headed, and I said in the room, I said, you know, down the road, people are going to be going to three or four qualifiers. And people laughed at me because they thought that was funny that somebody, that I would be stupid enough to think that people would go to three or four qualifiers, which we all know now that there may be some clubs that go to five, but we know there's a lot of clubs that go to three or four. And, you know, a lot of times they fly to all of them. And so it's one of the things that, you know, it's just, it made some of the stuff, it's made this landscape for so many almost unaffordable. And, you know, when we first started the club, we would rarely fly more than once a year to any tournament other than nationals. So we might fly to California to play in a tournament. And then if nationals was far away, we might fly there, but that would be it. Everything else was going to be local. And now you have teams getting on airplanes four or five times a year. And I mean, just think about the cost of that alone. And so I think that's one of the key things. And, you know, the JVA, they've lost their way. And I think that's, it's never been more apparent now. If you just look and you see, you know, you see an organization where your own board members send their teams to other events on the same weekend as your biggest most prestigious tournament of the year, your own board members. And to me, that says everything that you need to know about the commitment of an organization and its leadership to the original mission that it was founded on. And I think the JVA has run from that mission. You know, they don't want to compete with it. They want to be everybody's friend. And if we as club directors had multiple organizations competing, providing models that we could go into that would allow us to develop elite talent and elite teams, you know, that's a win-win for everybody in club volleyball. That's a win-win. And the reason I say that, as opposed, and a lot of people are going to go, well, we need one association that brings everybody together. We only need that if that association supports and pays all of our bills. If we support those organizations, then we're the customer. If we're the customer, then we want the best customer service. And, you know, with, you know, what I just mentioned about the JVA, about its own board members not supporting it. Imagine working at Pepsi and your boss comes over for dinner on the weekend and your refrigerator is full of Coke. Imagine working for McDonald's or being a McDonald's franchisee and you see all your staff at Burger King. You know, one of the things that you have to do is, if you're going to create a great product, you have to understand that you thrive and you succeed in the world of competition. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, that we've gotten away from. And anytime you get away from competition, then you drift towards monopoly. And if you drift towards a monopoly, then people dictate what you do. You're as the customer, don't dictate what they do for you. And so I think that's one of the reasons. And, you know, the biggest thing, and one of the reasons that I say this, and I speak so strongly on this, is because, you know, Cheryl and my wife and I, you know, we now are in Atlanta. We have a small club down here. And it's a club that we want to train. We want to develop our athletes. You know, our goal isn't to be big. We have four courts and we're not doing, you know, our goal is not, we've done that already. But we have some talented kids. And, you know, I look around at the ability for these kids, we have about 95% African American in our club. And, you know, we have great kids. And, you know, these are good families. You know, they're suburban families in general. But we have almost no families who can afford to spend $15,000 or $20,000 a year. I mean, we're so much lower than that right now because we have a different model. But if we ask our families to spend $15,000 or $20,000 a year, we would lose almost all of our players. It just wouldn't be feasible. It wouldn't be possible. And so one of the things that we've started looking at is, how do we take gifted athletes who have very little volleyball experience, you know, who didn't have strong elementary school or junior high volleyball programs, who didn't have coaching when they were young, how do we take these gifted athletes who are now older, and how do we catch up? And if we're going to catch up, how do we do it? And we can't put them on a plane four or five times. We don't fly at all. I mean, we drive to AAUs. We drive to Orlando. It's an 8-hour drive from Atlanta. You know, we drive to Louisville to the JVA events and to, you know, Bluegrass. But it's one of the reasons that, you know, that we started the Champions League. And the Champions League, this, you know, you've heard the pod. If you haven't heard the podcast on the CLVP, we kind of go into it there. But one of the reasons that we started the CLVP was, it will allow our athletes here who are gifted athletes to become much better volleyball players, because we can now provide a competitive model that's much more affordable. You go for a weekend and you get probably 4, 5, 6 days of normal tournament play in the same amount of time because of the structure of the CLVP. And then our kids can grow and develop, you know, and we can do it in an affordable manner. And, you know, those are the reasons that we're doing what we're doing here. But what we're doing here would be far better for those clubs who are much further along than we are here. Because if you look around the world, you don't need to play 100 matches a year. If you're an elite, let's say you're an elite 17 or 18 or even a 16 or 15 team, you go to all these tournaments. Teams go to all these tournaments. How many times do you step on the court and you know that you're most likely going to win the match before the match starts? Or you know you're most likely going to lose the match before the match starts. But, you know, the thing that we look at is, if you look around the world at all the great volleyball that's being played, if you look at some of the the professional matches from Turkey and Italy and Brazil. I mean, the level of play is so high and it's so good. And other than the American players, nobody went through this system. Nobody did. You know, they went through a system where they played a lot less, they practiced more, but when they played hard. They competed at the highest level possible. Quality of play, quality of elite play, was far better than going away and playing seven matches on a weekend and you're 6-1 and you know you got to the semis and you really started getting challenged. And you spent how much money to do that? So, you know, those are the things that concern me as, you know, somebody who's been doing this for a long time, somebody who's trying to build really a unique kind of a boutique club here in Atlanta, because again, we're not trying to be big. You know, we just want to give kids who want to train at a high level, we want to give them the opportunity to be the best players possible. And we had good success. I mean, the first year, last year, it was far as, you know, just we've kind of been implementing some new plans along the way. And, you know, we had, you know, two of our kids, you know, get Division I scholarships, you know, and, you know, kids who had, one of the kids had set the bench the year before on a team. And, you know, the other kid had been in a YMCA program, grassroots program. And so, you know, our focus has always been on training. And if you've listened to this podcast series, you know how much we believe in it. But this podcast has been about the competition model, because I think that, you know, there's so much more that we could do. And again, you know, with our club, the cost is prohibitive. We could never have a large group of kids do what most kids are doing in the clubs, because we just couldn't afford it. Second of all, you know, it's given us a chance to put the Champions League Volleyball Project model together and see not only how valuable it is for elite level kids, because you get so much competition in a short period of time, but it's a great developer of grassroots level, of young kids, of, you know, regional level kids, because they get so many more game opportunities and there's such a good level of intensity. And they get to play right through a lot of the things that they, you know, would never have time to do otherwise, because they don't practice or play that much. So I guess those are the two things that we've found here that we think are going to be really beneficial for our club. But, you know, and I don't want this to sound negative. I mean, you know, I think I'm critical, but I love volleyball. You know, I love the structure of volleyball. I love everything about it. So I think one of the things that, you know, I'll leave you with my five recommendations, which don't mean anything, but, you know, I'm going to give them to you anyhow. So if you're a club director, one of the things I would suggest that you do is to send out a survey to your parents and ask them one question. What was your total out-of-pocket expenses for your daughter to participate for the entire 2023-2024 club season, including club dues, apparel, tournament expenses, travel, food, lodging, parking, you know, et cetera, everything that was associated with their daughter playing? I think you're going to be shocked at the amount of money that people spend. And this was my come to Jesus meeting moment in 2007, when I asked one of the parents in our club at Sports Performance to tell me how much money that he was spending a year, because he was an accountant. I mean, so he had it down to the penny. And, you know, our club fees then were maybe probably less than $1,500. I mean, they weren't very much money. But he told me that he gave me the accounting. He spent over $10,000 just one season. Over one season, just over $10,000. And that was a long time ago. So those numbers have just skyrocketed since then, especially now, which, you know, parking, entry fee into tournaments has just blown up since COVID. I mean, I remember it used to be $5 or $6 or $7. Now it's, you know, that's another thing we like about the Champions League is, you know, there's no cost for parking. And, you know, it's like $8 to get in. So you're saving so much more money. You're playing a lot more volleyball. But that was my come to Jesus moment when I found out that we had kids. And that this kid was on our second team, wasn't even on our first team, that we're spending over $10,000 a year then, and now it's gone way past that. So that's number one. I think you're going to be shocked at how much money's being spent. Another thing I would suggest is if your goal is to be elite, then that starts in your own gym. I mean, I would commit to at least 9 hours a week of structured, deliberate practice where the work on the court mirrors the goals of your team during competition. I think that's important. Don't just rely on playing more and more matches to prepare your players for the elite level. A college or pro schedule is 3 to 5 practices a week, one to two matches a week on the weekend generally, and then more practice in the off season, lifting the rest of the year. You know, there's really not that much team play. And so, you know, we go from an upside down model where young kids play way too much, they practice very little, and then it's the practice that gives you the skill sets, you know, going back to Caitlin Clark and going back to how Yale can beat Auburn and how Oakland can beat Kentucky. You know, it's people who have great skill because they put lots of hours in the gym honing that skill. I think that's one of the things that's important. And I think for your most talented players and teams, play at your skill level, not your age level. Challenge your most talented kids to play above their level, not down to somebody else's level. And, you know, that's one of the problems with the American system is you have 11s and then you have 12s and then you have 13s. And there are kids who have never played outside their age group. And then within those age groups, you've got five or six different divisions. So, you know, we won the whatever division it was. So you're really 125th best team at the tournament, which I get that those are all opportunities and people love all that stuff. And we now live in a trophy for everyone culture. But if you have good kids, play them against competition where they struggle and it's hard and they fail. That's going to be one of the most important things. And if you have teams at that level, your team should be doing the same thing because you're, especially if you're a club director, you're training people to leave. You're training people to leave you and go somewhere else and be better. And I think that's one of the most important missions you have is that you did such a good job that when they went to the next level, they stood out from the experience and the training that you gave them. I think that's one of the things that's important. Number four is I would make player development a priority over team success. And then you're really providing a customer service because the parents in your club teach, pay you the money to train and teach their daughters how to play volleyball. So the player is really the customer. So it's what you do to develop that customer. It's where the money's spent. And if you have a great team, and there's seven kids on your team who are rocking it, and there's five kids on your team who rarely see the court, they all pay the same money, then in my book, you gave seven people great customer service, maybe five if they did a great job in training and they were happy with not playing, you know. But one of the focuses always should be on talent development, and you'll see that if you go back, and especially if you read the article on IOX, the Youth Soccer Academy in Holland, you'll see that. And another thing is team success will always follow if you have great players. It's inevitable that you'll have a great team if all your kids are good because generally your team will always break down from player weaknesses. A player will make a mistake, team will lose. You know, teams don't make mistakes, players make mistakes. That's one of the things I think that you want to look at. So, and the last one is evaluate your schedule to see if more is better or playing better is better. And I think that's one of the things to look at. So do you have to play so much? Or you just have to find better people to sharpen your iron on? Because if iron sharpens iron, then you need to be playing against iron. And I think that's one of the key things. So I want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen to this. I know we had a lot in it and there's a lot to unpack. And I want to wish all you guys, especially if you're club coaches or directors, a great end of your season. And hoping you have a great summer as summer's coming on. And I want to wish everybody all the best. Thank you.